Well, good evening. We are going to finish Judges chapter 21 tonight. I had mentioned the possibility of doing so last week. It did not happen. This is our last session on Judges 21. The entire book, starting next Wednesday, will be in a new series on the Old Testament books of the law compared to New Testament grace and how the Old Testament law plays into the life of a believer and which parts of the law God would have us to follow and which parts He would not and why that would be the case. But that starts next Wednesday. Tonight, let's look at Judges chapter 21. To bring you up to speed, remember, we are at a point in Israel's history before the time of the kings, before King David, before King Saul. Even the prophet Samuel has not yet been born. This is the time after Gideon, the time after Samson, Samson being the last judge recorded in this book for us. We're told multiple times in the last few chapters that there was no king in Israel and every man did that what was right in his own eyes. In fact, in Judges chapter 21, let's go ahead and turn there to verse 25. And this entire book ends with that phrase. In those days, there was no king in Israel. Every man did that which was right in his own eyes. Why does God keep mentioning this verse? Because of the atrocities that you find in the previous 3 to 4 chapters, the atrocities you're going to find in this chapter, it could be easy for you to say, God, what are you thinking? Why would you do this? Why would you tell the Israelites to do this? God has already made it very clear. And like a teacher who wants to make sure the students understand the lesson and heard the truth, he says it multiple times. God is in control, yes, but God is allowing the Israelites to make their own bad choices and suffer the consequences of their choices. Now, that's kind of a scary thought in light of what's going on in our country today and this week and what will be going on. It is often said that when there's chaos, God is in control. And yes, obviously, God's in control. But that phrase doesn't mean that God is literally a puppeteer in heaven forcing us to do different things. God is not forcing unbelievers to do what He wants them to do. God is not forcing believers to do what He wants them to do. The idea that God's in control means that even the worst decisions made by the worst of people doesn't change the ultimate outcome of God's plan. That's what it means that God's in control. The idea that you as a parent are in control of your household does not mean that you have your kids in some manner tied to some sticks that you move around and, you know, you pick up the water when you want and you make them drink it and you make them, you know, clean their rooms with this puppeteer sticks. The idea that you're in control of your house means in the end, you win. Your kids don't win. But there are some times of chaos in your home. There are some times of you wonder, you scratch your head wondering, what in the world was my child doing? Now, God doesn't scratch His head because God knows all. But in a sense, God allows us to have our chaos here on earth. And if today doesn't represent time of chaos, I don't know what does politically represent a time of chaos. And so we should be grateful that God's in control, but understand that doesn't mean God is controlling every aspect of every person's life in America or in the world. God does allow chaos. God does allow the free will of man, but God has the end game in sight, which is His glory. It is His kingdom, and there is nothing that can stop the end game for God. There is nothing that can break down the gates of His kingdom, the gates of His church. God says hell cannot come against His church, can't break down His church. God is going to make sure that stands. That doesn't mean that His church won't suffer along the way, but completely annihilated, not going to happen. It will never be annihilated. God will take it to heaven and then usher us into the tribulation period, those that are still here, those that are not saved. But hopefully that brings you some comfort while also bringing you some doctrine. Because, again, I've seen a lot today on Facebook and a lot of people have said, well, God's in control. And I almost feel like they think that God is somehow making all of this happen. I don't believe that's in Scripture. God has not made all this happen, but God has allowed this to happen just as He allows Judges chapter 21. And allowing and making aren't the same thing. So don't confuse God to be a violent, malicious, wrathful God, because if you think God's in control, Judges 21, in the sense of doing everything, then that's exactly who He is. But God doesn't say that. So what's happening? In the previous chapters, we found that the Israelites had gotten very upset with the tribe Benjamin. Remember, there's 13 tribes, really. Oftentimes when you hear Israel, you hear the 12 tribes of Israel. But those are the 12 land-owning tribes of Israel. The 13th tribe, the tribe of Levi, didn't own land. And so in a sense was a tribe that was part of all tribes. The Levites traveled throughout Israel and had Levites stationed in different parts for different reasons. So there was no land-owning tribe of Levi. There were 12 landowners and a 13th non-landowner, Levi. But when you think of the tribes of Levi, you think of Benjamin. Benjamin was one of the tribes of Levi, tribes of Israel, Benjamin being one of the tribes of Israel. And we find that Benjamin was at a very dark place spiritually in their history. At the end of Judges, they were at a place where they didn't want to tell people what to do. Every man did what was right in his own eyes, and Benjamin was one of the worst offenders. The Benjamites, they could rape, they could pillage, and they wouldn't be told no. There was no authority, there was no governor, there was no sheriff putting people in jail, arresting people, and saying, no, you cannot kill, you cannot rape, you cannot steal. People, the strongest arm won. There was a traveling Levite through Benjamin, and due to unfortunate circumstances and the violence of the Benjamites, he lost his wife. And because of that, she was killed by the Benjamites. Israel went to war against Benjamin, civil war. All the tribes, the Levites would not have been one of them. Again, not being landowners, the Levites also didn't fight in war. The Levites were the priestly tribe. So of the 12 land-owning tribes and of the 12 warrior tribes, 11 tribes versus one tribe. And all 11 tribes had representation going to war against Benjamin. The entire nation or tribe of Benjamin was at war against parts of every other tribe. We saw in the previous chapters that Benjamin actually did pretty well for the first couple of days, killing tens of thousands when they only lost a few hundred every day. And then finally, the Israelites came to God on the third day and said, God, are we supposed to go to war again? Because it hasn't been going well. And God says, go to war again the third day, and this time you're going to win. Now, God did not tell the Israelites to destroy all the Benjamites. He just said, go and fight and have the victory. But the Israelites, this is where we ended in Judges chapter 20. They got so emotionally involved in the battle. There was such a bloodlust that, remember, brother against brother, civil war, nation fighting against itself. The 11 tribes of Israel, those that were represented at this time, didn't just kill the warriors of Benjamin. They killed the women. They killed the children. They killed the men. The men who weren't actually warriors. Those who were tradesmen. Those who were traders, farmers, didn't have a sword, never owned a sword, never swung a sword. If they were a Benjamite, they were killed. There was only 600 Benjamite males, and it seems that they were the warriors. They escaped. Everyone else slaughtered. Can you imagine what must have been going through the heads of these Israelites to kill men, women, children? I'm not sure that I can. I can't really fathom what is going on in the mind of a person where they would be willing to slaughter innocent children, slaughter men and women who aren't even fighting. The Israelites, probably so upset for losing the previous 2 days, that when they finally won, everyone dies. Have you noticed that's the case in human nature? That if you're losing a game, Monopoly especially, or Risk, that if you're losing, you kind of step outside of your own reality and now you're throwing the board. And you wouldn't normally be that kind of person. But as you walk away, you oops, and like, I mean, the pieces are everywhere, right? And you're not really that kind of person, and yet here you are doing things you wouldn't normally do because you're so upset for losing. And it's even worse when the losers finally start winning. Oh, they are just horrible. The things that they'll say, the things that they'll do, the way they'll treat other people. Little kids. So they're losing a game and they're all mad because they're losing. And then they start winning and, oh, yeah, you guys are all losers, see? And then they're starting dancing on the table and calling you names. So I feel like on a much deeper, darker spiritual level, on a much worse, violent, emotional level, that's what's happening with the Israelites. They've lost upwards to 40,000 men in just 2 days, while the Benjamites losing less than 1,000. It just drove them insane. So that when they finally started winning, they were insane. And they couldn't stop killing. And they killed everyone except for 600. What's the application for us? Don't lose control. Don't lose control of the argument. Don't turn it into an argument to begin with. If it does, don't lose control of yourself in it. Don't lose control of yourself when talking about politics, because right now, your biggest danger right now is losing your testimony through politics. And what a horrible way to lose your testimony. Folks, I started this lesson by reminding you, God being in control doesn't mean God is forcing everything to happen the way it is. But you've got to remember, God being in control means nothing that happens now changes the end. Nothing that happens now changes where you and I are going. For eternity, folks, for eternity. Nothing that happens today or this week or next week changes the fact that we'll live on this earth for 1,000 years in paradise with Christ. That doesn't change. Nothing changes the imminent return of Christ in the clouds and his second return to the earth. Nothing changes your salvation. Nothing changes your relationship with Christ except you. You can change that. President Trump, Vice President Biden, they can't change those things. Senators, House members, they can't change your relationship with Christ. Only your choices can do that. Only your choices can cause you to turn your back on God and go into a dark place spiritually where you wonder where God is. You abandon him. Politics didn't do that. You did that. Do not let temporary politics affect your eternal relationship with Christ. Do not get such a bloodlust that if in your way politically, whatever way that is, you start winning, that you literally go crazy on your own friends. Thanksgiving comes around. You just can't wait for Thanksgiving to rub it in the faces of people that have been mouthing off to you. You can't wait to rub it in their faces for Thanksgiving. You are the Israelites just slaughtering uncontrollably. And you're doing it with your words. Well, finally, at the end of chapter 20, what do we find? The Israelites have a little bit of regret. Not a little bit, a lot, right? They look around themselves and there's dead bodies of children and of women. Dead bodies of soldiers mingled with dead bodies of farmers. They're looking around and they're saying, where are all the Benjamites? Did we kill them all? Wow. What have we done? Then they start thinking, are we really about to lose one of our own tribes? One of our 12, you know, major tribes? Are we going to be short a tribe? What a tragedy. A little late to be thinking of tragedies after you've already done the deed, right? How many people do you know, they only regret the tragedy after they've already done it? There's no regret in the path they're about to take. There's no regret as they're taking it. The regret is only the consequences of the choice they already made. And that's not true regret when you only regret the consequences, not the actual decision. You see, the Israelites aren't regretting the fact that they killed men, women, and children. That's not mentioned here. They're only regretting that, oops, we don't have a tribe of Benjamin now. That's a regret of a consequence. That's like the kid being sorry because they got caught, not because they were wrong. And adults do the same thing. Too many of us, we get sorry only when we're caught, not because we've done wrong. I was reading the post of someone, no one in this city, no one in this church, no one in this school. You guys don't know them. I don't even know them. A friend of mine who doesn't even live in Connecticut, a friend of mine posted something and they said, hey, I know someone who has had an affair, and they're feeling bad about it. So they came to this person, so it's a pastor, went to this pastor and said, I need help. I feel bad, but don't tell my wife. It would break her. So this pastor was asking for advice. What should I do? And I was glad to see other pastors were, I didn't have to, because they were saying, look, first of all, you got to tell the man's wife. The guy's playing you. Because if you don't tell the guy's wife now, when she finds out, you'll lose her trust. And one guy said it really well. He said, this guy doesn't seem to really regret his choices. He's just regretting the place he's in, not what he actually did. And until he actually regrets his choices and only regrets the consequences, you can't really help him. Help him see the problem is not his wife's going to be mad. That's a consequence of the real problem, his unfaithfulness. Unfortunately, this guy didn't see it. I didn't see the end result. I didn't, you know, ask this person what happened. You know, not really my business. He got all the advice he needed. But, you know, a lot of us are the same way. In whatever instance, argument, we think that giving a flower to our spouse fixes the problem of yelling at them the night before. We think that making them a meal erases the fact that we called them names the morning of, right? Look, the real problem is the attitude and the actions, not the consequence that they're mad at you. The Israelites never repent of the real problem. They're violent dark spiritual condition. So, chapter 21, verse 1, here we are. The nation of Israel is at a loss. What should we do now? The tribe of Benjamin could be eliminated permanently. And so the men of Israel had sworn in Mizpah, saying, "There shall not any of us give his daughter unto Benjamin unto wife." All right, so before the battle even began, they met in Mizpah. And the 11 tribes and the representatives of the 11 tribes said, "Benjamin deserves to go to war. We can't help them. We can't assist them. And we should not intermarry with them." Not forever in the future history of Israel, but our children today cannot be given in marriage to the Benjamites. They're so wicked, which implies the Israelites did not intend to wipe out the Benjamites going into war, because even before they went to war, they said, "When this is done, we're not marrying them." It was a mistake for them to wipe out Benjamin. It wasn't a plan. So now they're thinking back, well, we can't give them our daughters. Who's them? The 600 men that survived. There's only 600 guys, warriors. No wives, no children. If they had them, they'd been killed. They'd been murdered. So they're either widowers or were never married. And so the Israelites say the only way to maintain the tribe of Benjamin is for these 600 men to have children of their own. But we can't give them children, because before the war started, we made a commitment to our God and to each other that we would not help them or marry them. Well, isn't that ironic? Now you're going back on your spiritual elitist condition that we would never dare break a covenant with God when you just murdered men, women, and children. How ironic for you to pull out the God card now and to say, well, we couldn't break our honor and make this decision. It would be breaking a covenant with God, and that would dishonor us. And how is not chapter 20 bringing dishonor upon you? But in some way, in some weird, twisted way, these Israelites still think they have honor. Again, not so much different from us today. We are unfaithful emotionally to our spouses, even physically. We're unfaithful to our God. We're unfaithful to His people. We lie, we deceive, we cheat, we steal. And yet, we still think we have some type of honor that we're not willing to break. You've lost your honor. The best thing to do is to recognize you threw it away a long time ago, to humble yourself and to start making repairs. Not hold on to this last seeming sliver of honor and therefore not fix any problems. So the Israelites, because of their honor, say there's nothing to do. In verse 2, they're so upset, we're told they lift up their voices and they wept sore. I mean, grown men, tears, snot coming out of their nose. These guys are uncontrollably emotional. I mean, they were uncontrollably emotional during war. Now they're uncontrollably emotional after war. And so they finally come up with a plan. And they say, all right, here's what we're going to do. We're going to search the kingdom of all 11 tribes and see, was there a part of any tribe who didn't send a representative? Remember, I told you it was basically 10% of every tribe. So this village sent 5 guys, this village sent 100 guys. Depending on the size of the village, they would have sent 10% of their men, so 10% of every tribe was represented. So they wanted to see, was there any city or village that didn't even send one man? And therefore, wasn't part of our covenant. And so they can give their daughters and not have to bring dishonor upon us. But not only that, they also started talking and saying, hey, part of that covenant, didn't we say we'd kill whoever didn't actually represent their tribe as well? So they found a place. And this place was part of the tribe of Manasseh, a smaller tribe. And we're told that they decided, this place is called Jabesh-Gilead, by the way. First time it's mentioned in the Bible up to this point. Jabesh-Gilead is mentioned later. I'll explain where it's mentioned later in the book of 1 Samuel. But for right now, never been mentioned before. So if you were reading the Bible, Genesis to this point, this is the first time you hear it. Jabesh-Gilead. It's a tribe in Manasseh. So it is a city of Jews. This is not non-Jews. These are Jews. These Jews made the bad decision to not send men to call to war. Now, I have no doubt that when the call to war was made, the warning was given, if you don't send men, you're going to die. These guys in Jabesh-Gilead didn't take the warning seriously, didn't care, thought surely they wouldn't follow through with it. They didn't send even one man. It was the only place that we're told that was discovered to not have sent at least one man. So the Israelites, they were told that they gathered together 12,000. And the Bible uses verse 10, 12,000 of their valiantest, their bravest, the best, the elite, the Green Berets, the Navy SEALs, whatever group you want to call. They sent the best to this one city, Jabesh-Gilead. And what do? Slaughtered again. Men, women, children, killed them all. Only ones that survived were women who had never had a sexual relationship, virgins. That was it. And kind of interesting, in this fairly large city, only 400 met that qualification. So that kind of gives you a little more detail. Again, every man does what's right in his own eyes. There wasn't a whole lot of honor in any of these lives. You know, people sleeping around with people. Remember the tribe of Benjamin, rapists. So unmarried women just sleeping around. It was common. For a large city to only have 400, that's a head scratcher. Maybe they killed virgins not knowing they were virgins. I don't know. But they only ended up with 400 women. So how do you feel about that? You think that was a good choice? Good job, Israelites. You kept your honor, your covenant with God by slaughtering men, women, and children because they didn't go to war with you against their own brothers. Because the town of Jabesh-Gilead didn't want to participate in civil war. You killed them all and took 400 unmarried young women and forced them into marriage against four of the 600 Benjamite warriors. Yeah, that was a great decision. You know what I'm finding? A lot of emotions going on here. Emotions that caused them to even go to war in the first place. Emotions that caused them to slaughter the Benjamite tribe almost en masse. And emotions that bring them to the point of slaughtering an entire village, Jabesh-Gilead, entire city. Emotions. You know where emotions will take you? Everywhere. Everywhere and anywhere. There is nowhere you are not capable of ending up when you let your emotions drive you. You know what the world says? You know what a lot of parents say? They say, follow your heart. You know what that biblical definition of follow your heart is? It's follow your emotions. Because that's what the heart represents. The heart represents what you feel, what you want, what you desire, what you think you need, your emotional needs. When we tell someone to follow their heart, we are literally telling them to do whatever you feel. In fact, that's often said, well, what do you feel is right? Do what you feel is right. You are sending them down the path of destruction. Because here is a prime example of where your emotions can take you. Death, destruction, previously rape, horrible things. Christians are capable of any and every sin. Don't tell me that Christians can't commit certain sins. I will show you saints in the Bible who've committed them all. Horrible things. That doesn't mean you're not saved. It just means you're not walking with Christ and you're letting your emotions control you. Is it possible for someone to not be saved and claim they are? Of course it is. Of course that's possible. But we know in Scripture, and Lot is an example of people who did horrible things and yet were still saved, according to Hebrews chapter 11. Lot's just one example. Our emotions are not our friend. They are often our worst enemy. You know what our friend is? Truth is our friend. Self-control for the Christian is called spirit control, something these guys didn't have. So they take the 400 girls, virgins, they give them to the Benjamites. Verse 14, the Benjamites came again at that time. They gave them the wives which they had saved alive of the women of Jabesh-Gilead, and yet so they sufficed them not. The Benjamites weren't really too thrilled about this. They just slaughtered a village for you guys. They gave you some wives. Why weren't the Benjamites happy about this? What do you think? How many men were there? How many women were there? Yeah, the math didn't add up for these guys. They're like, that's not going to work. What about the rest of us 200 that didn't get a wife? I mean, these guys, these Benjamites. It's hard for me to use the word grateful because of how everything happened. I don't want to use the word grateful, but they still want more. They want them to go slaughter another village and kill more men, women, and children and bring 200 more women? Yes, that's what the Benjamites want. These guys have no moral compass. The Benjamites' philosophy is basically, give it to me or else. And so the Israelites, they start crying again. Oh no, what are we going to do? Is 400 virgins and 400 Benjamites enough to restart the tribe? You know, we need 200 more women. But there are no more cities. And the Jabesh-Gilead, they're all dead, so we can't get any more virgins from them. So we shouldn't go and slaughter a city who was part of the civil war because they're part of the community. You know, they're part of our squad. So it wouldn't be right to kill our own. You killed the Benjamites. You killed the Jabesh-Gileads. This one line of honor that you draw, and you won't cross that, but you'll cross everything else, doesn't make sense. But for them, it did. So they came up with another plan. They said, okay, if we can't give our daughters to the Benjamites without breaking our oath, and we can't slaughter any more villages because there was only one and that's a done deal, and we can't take girls from foreign nations because God doesn't want us marrying unbelieving Jews or unbelieving non-Jews, you know, heaven forbid that would happen. And they've crossed every other line, but we won't do that. There's only one thing left to do. We have to kidnap some girls. So, in verse number 17, they said there must be an inheritance for them that be escaped of Benjamin. That tribe be not destroyed. We've got to get them all full 600 girls. Howbeit, verse 18, we may not give them wives of our daughters. We've already made that commitment. Not going to happen. So, verse 19, they are reminded of a feast of the Lord in Shiloh. Shiloh is where the tabernacle was. And the feasts, there was many feasts held there. Feast of Tabernacles, the Passover feast. A lot of commentators believe it was the Feast of Tabernacles. And during this feast, the virgin women, the unmarried women, would dance. The married women would not. The married men, the men would not. It would just be the unmarried women. Not in a provocative way. In Jewish culture, dancing was often jumping up and down and kind of swinging in circles. Not swinging your hips necessarily or trying to attract a man. They were just jumping as they worshipped God. So this gets really, really bad. The Israelites say, let's essentially, in modern terms, go kidnap them from church. Because that's basically what's happening at Shiloh. It's a worship service. It's a worship feast. And it's during this worship feast that everyone's guards will be down. There's no one going to be guarding the city. No one's guarding the gates. No one's marching around with weapons. It's a time of worship. It's a time where we're focusing on God, and everyone's our friend. It's the perfect crime, they say. And so they find the Benjamites, and they say, okay, here's the plan. Go to this particular place at this time, and you will find the worship feast taking place. People will be honoring God. Now, are they truly honoring God? I don't know. I kind of feel like it's a sham anyways. I'm not convinced that this Feast of Tabernacles, that these Jews at this time truly were like repenting and loving God as they should sincerely. I think it was just traditional religion. But even so, they felt it was sincere. And they said, when you go there, you'll see the young unmarried women. You can't miss them. They're the only ones dancing. So basically, if they're dancing, you can take them. Now, you know what's really interesting? I don't think that these leaders of Israel let their daughters dance that day. What do you think? So basically, they're saying you can kidnap our neighbor's daughters on this day to make up for our bad decision. Again, not much different than today. People make bad financial problems and they want others to pay for those problems. That's essentially, in my philosophy, the whole push behind free college education. People who didn't prepare, people who didn't save up, they want everyone else who didn't have a chance to go to college or already paid for their own to pay for those who weren't ready. For those who already went to college and paid off, they want you to pay it off. Now, you can have your own philosophy on how college might look, but if it's the government paying, it's you and I paying for the college education of someone else who didn't want to pay for their experience when we already did. Most in this room, if we went, we did. And that's the philosophy. That's the philosophy a lot of people are going today, is I made some mistakes and I want you to pay for my mistakes. And how dare you have more than me? And it doesn't matter that my decisions got me here. It's not fair that we're not in the same place. So I want you to give me more. And that was essentially what the Israelites said. Oh, we made a mistake. Let's let these guys pay for our mistake. These fathers. Can you imagine, dads? Your daughter being kidnapped, and then when you go to the police, they say, sorry, nothing we can do. That's just how it is. And into a forced marriage. And by the way, we're not talking like 20, 30-year-old adult women here, probably. We're probably talking teenagers. We're probably talking 15-year-old girls. I would imagine no older than 19 in that culture, You know, 20 and older was kind of like an old maid in that culture. Not to say that it is today. That's just what it was then. So I'd imagine these men aren't looking for what they would call older women, although it's likely a lot of these men were older men. How would you feel if a 40-year-old man comes and kidnaps your 15-year-old daughter and the police say, sorry, this is how it is? That's what's going on right here. And these are the leaders of Israel making those kind of decisions for other people. That's how bad it is right now in Israel at this point. So the Benjamites, they think this is a great idea. So they get their 200 men together and they go and kind of sneak into the city. They see these virgins dancing, these young women dancing. And we're told in verse 21 that they come out in the vineyards, they catch every man his wife. And by the way, they're told, this is still being told what to do. This is what they're going to do. It's still the description of what they should. Get them out of the vineyards, you know, out of the byways, out of the back streets, out of the main roads. I mean, these girls just would have been dancing everywhere. It's not like a centrally located place. They just would have been dancing through the community, almost kind of like a parade, just everywhere. The whole city was afire with a religious ceremony. And so you just, when you found one that was pretty to you, you take them and you go. And here's what they said in verse 22. They said, when this happens and when you kidnap these girls, the fathers are inevitably going to come to us. Who is us? These must be the leaders of the tribes, the various tribe leaders. They said, the dads of our tribes are going to come to us and they're going to say, hey, our daughters are kidnapped. Let's go get them back. And these tribe leaders say, this is what we'll tell them. When they complain to us, they call it complaining, as if wanting your daughter back from kidnapping is complaining, right? But that's what they say. They say, when they complain, we will say unto them, be favorable unto them for our sakes. That's no small request, by the way. Oh, let them keep the girls for our sakes. Our sakes who? The leader's sakes. Why? For their honor. What honor? Of a covenant they made to a God that they don't even worship. We don't want to lose our honor, so you got to lose your daughter for our sakes. Because we reserve not to each man his own wife in the war, meaning, you know, we made a stupid decision. We killed all their wives. I mean, oh, that was just a really bad thing. You know, we regret that. But now they don't have wives. This is the only option available to us. For ye did not give them unto them at this time that ye should be guilty. They're basically saying, and don't worry, don't worry. You can keep your honor too, because you didn't break your covenant, because you didn't give your daughters to them. They were stolen from you. So see, everyone wins. Everyone keeps their honor. It's all good. Don't worry about it. None of us broke our covenant, and the Benjamites gets wives, and the tribe remains. It's just with your daughters, but it's okay. Don't fret. And the children of Benjamin did so and took them wives according to their number of them that danced whom they caught. I really wonder, I'm sure the leaders didn't have their daughters. Do you think they maybe told some of their good friends, hey, just don't ask me why, but don't let your daughter outside that night. You think they might have gone to their best friends and say, hey, worship from your house. Don't let your daughter leave the house. Don't let her leave the backyard area. Make sure her brother's with her if she's going to do that. Don't ask me why. We don't want to spread any news. I'm sure there was some insider information going on. And so it was those who were not connected to the strong and powerful that lost the most. Nothing much different today, is there? Those who are connected to the strong and powerful, whether on a community level or a national level, whether on a world level, they're the ones that know what's going on, and they're the ones that get away with everything. It's those who are not connected that have to pay for the mistakes of those who are connected. My goal today was not to dishearten you, but to remind you what we're experiencing today is the way of the world. There is nothing new under the sun. Nothing God hasn't already been confronted with in the past. And if God delays his coming, nothing that he will not be confronted with again. And yet, we find, after the book of Judges, comes the book of 1 Samuel. Not immediately. Of course, there's Ruth. And Ruth is during the time of Judges. But after this time comes the time of 1 Samuel. And what do we find in 1 Samuel? A prophet. A prophet that was unique in many ways. A prophet who also was a judge, who began a revival for the Israelite nation, leading to King Saul, which eventually led to King David and King Solomon, the golden age of Israel. I'm not telling you that this pattern will be repeated here in America. I'm not telling you this pattern is going to be repeated on a world stage level. I'm just telling you that in the darkest of days for Israel, God was not held back from bringing good days in the future if he so chose. And if God stands back and says, you know what, I'm not going to control you like puppets, I'll let you have your moment of chaos. If God in control allows that to happen, that doesn't mean God can't or won't bring back another time in the future that would be more enjoyable than what we're going through now. But if God does not, and if his time is more imminent than even we know tonight, that time will still arrive. It will just be an eternal time of joy for us. Folks, whether we enter a time of political and spiritual darkness, regardless of which side of the aisle you're on, and regardless of how you see that playing out in your own heart and mind, whether we enter that time of spiritual darkness or not should never affect what a Christian does. Because what are Christians called to do at all times? Love God and love your neighbor. All times. Politics should not change who and how we love. Unfortunately, I believe it's going to. I believe that we're at a point where many people who call themselves Christians, their love will be highly affected in the coming weeks, months, and years by how things play out in the next week or two. That ought not be the case. I think there are Christians who will stop going to church. God, if you can't even control an election, then why would I go to church? God, if you would let this person, whoever that might be a leader on a community level, state level, national level, well, then how can I trust you with my life? And I think there's a lot of Christians, well, who call themselves, whether they are or not, I don't know, but a lot of religious people who will throw their religion to the wayside because of the chaos they're experiencing. That's unfortunate. At a time where you need God most, to throw him to the wayside, really, you're throwing yourself to the wayside is what's happening. Worst of times to do so. You see, here's what I believe very strongly. The light should never be afraid of the darkness. It is the darkness that flees when the light is turned on. And so if you fear the darkness, there can only be one reason. You lack the light. And if you're lacking the light, that choice is purely your own. In fact, I believe that the darker it gets, the brighter light shines. The lights are on right now in this building, and you haven't really noticed them. You didn't stare up at them even once, probably tonight. But if you were in a dark forest, and the moon was covered with clouds, and you couldn't see the hand in front of your face, and even one of these lights was shining, I guarantee you, most, if not everyone in this room, you know what you would do? You would start heading towards that light, wouldn't you? But no one's interested in heading towards any lights right now because we're surrounded by it. I am not saying to be excited about what is coming ahead, because I don't know what's coming ahead, but I am telling you there is no reason to fear of what's coming ahead. Because if things play out, as we might term, well, praise the Lord. If they do not, and we are required to go through a time of darkness, praise the Lord, because your one light will shine brighter than it ever has. And what do people walk towards when they're surrounded by darkness? The light. Be the light. And the best way to be the light is what Christ said. Love your neighbor. Love God. All the prophets and all of the law falls under this truth. Love. Love does not mean condone. Love does not mean enable. Love does not mean ignore sin. Love means treat with kindness and the basic level of honor due to all humanity. Love means to love people in truth to God, not love them to more sin. And would you be willing to enter into 4, 8, even 20 years of spiritually, politically dark times if that resulted in the salvation of your loved ones? Result in the salvation of those that you care about? If it resulted in mass amounts of people coming to the Lord in salvation, would you be willing to enter a dark time for that? You see, this idea of God's in control people want to say God is in control, but what they mean and what they define this term as, God is going to control things exactly the way I want Him to. That's what they mean. What it actually means is God has a plan bigger than just you. God has a plan bigger than the United States of America. God has a plan bigger than 2020, 2025, 2030. God has a plan bigger than the entire 21st century. God's plan is much bigger than we could possibly imagine. And God is in control of that plan. And God will allow whatever He needs to allow to bring about that plan. And you just got to trust Him through it. And don't turn off the light, folks. Don't turn off the light. The Israelites were in darkness. And you can just see the emotional turmoil they're going through because of their own bad decisions and regretting the consequences, not the actual choice, the consequences of their bad decisions. And we just look at them and shake our heads and say, what is wrong with these people? I'll tell you what's wrong with them. They've walked away from God while claiming to still be religious. The Feast of Tabernacles, their covenant with God supposedly holding them back in honor, claiming religion, living in utter spiritual darkness. Don't be that person. Verse 24, and the children of Israel departed thence at that time, every man to his tribe and to his family, and they went out from thence, every man to his inheritance. They got away with it. They got away with it. The Israelites' leaders' plan worked out just like they wanted. These young girls were kidnapped, married off forcefully to men they've never met before, and no one did anything. Why? Verse 25. Because in those days there was no king in Israel, and every man did that which was right in his own eyes. That's why. I do want to say this. Practically speaking, it is a heartbreaking story we just heard. And obviously long gone, thousands of years gone. But I want to point out something out. The tribe of Benjamin was a small tribe, but there was a lot of land. At one point, spread at least over 20-plus thousand warriors, not to mention farmers and older men who were too old to fight. So tens of thousands of families shared this land and this wealth. Who was left with all this wealth and land after this ordeal? These 600 Benjamites. They were pretty wealthy men. They came out on top. And although what was done to these 600 girls, 400 villages slaughtered, 200 kidnapped, and there's no justification for it, I do want to point out, these 600 girls married into wealth. They married into wealthy Benjamite families who, it would have been hard work. I mean, cities were burned and buildings destroyed, and they would have had to rebuild them, but they definitely had wealth to their name. And I want to point out one more thing. The first king of Israel was who? Saul. Which tribe did he come from? Benjamin. In all of this chaos, in all of this violence, God still uses the tribe of Benjamin by bringing about King Saul. Although King Saul didn't turn out to be the greatest of kings, I believe it was God's intention for that to be the case. Saul just messed it up. God can take even the chaos and bring about something beautiful. We're going to end there. So thank you so much for our online guests joining us tonight. Ended a little early, but there's no point in starting our series tonight on the books of the law. So join us next Wednesday as we start this new series on the Old Testament law and how it applies to New Testament believers. Thank you.